Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A former child soldier in South Sudan now aims to use humor to help others heal from emotional problems suffered during years of conflict. The comedian, Kuech Deng Atem, said he also wants to educate soldiers on how to improve their relations with civilians. The 26-year-old spoke with VOA about how he tries to use laughter to put smiles on the faces of the South Sudanese people. Atem said he hopes his jokes can disarm soldiers who harass citizens to get money from them. One of Atem's jokes deals with what he said is a common experience of many people in South Sudan. It involves being stopped by officers on the road who make false accusations about registration documents. The officers then demand money from the drivers. Atem is commonly known by his performing name of Wokeljish Commando. He became a soldier when he was 10 years old. He and other children were trained in Awil and Mapel and later joined the fighting in Hejlij and Abyei in 2006. He told VOA that in the beginning, child soldiers like him were mainly used to care for wounded soldiers and carry ammunition. In 2008, Atem's mother followed him to Mapel and was able to bring him back home to Juba, where he finally returned to school. That is where he started performing comedy and telling other students stories about life in the military. They would laugh, and teachers would come in sometimes and get me and be like, "Tell me the story," Atem said. I would tell them, and they would laugh. He said once one of the teachers suggested that he try telling his stories in front of all the students in an assembly. So I started doing this in the assembly, and people would laugh every morning. That's when I discovered that I could do stand-up comedy, Atem told VOA. In 2013, Atem joined a group called South Sudan Film Limited, which permitted him to perfect his comedic skills. Later, he started performing comedy skits on the state-run SSBC TV. He also joined another local stand-up comedy program called Kilu Kilu Ana. This led him to perform weekly at Juba's Nyakoron Cultural Center. Atem said he has won several awards for comedians in South Sudan. He is currently studying information technology in his final year at Juba's Starford International University. He said if his mother had not taken him out of the army, he might still be looking for the next war to fight in. Atem is urging the South Sudan government to take steps to prevent children from being recruited into the army. Young people should be permitted to study so that later, if they choose to join the army, they will be educated soldiers who can make good decisions. He added that comedy is one way to help ease the stress that many South Sudanese feel after living through years of civil war. He said he hopes one day to become an international success, so he can take his humor to other parts of the world to help people forget their painful past experiences. I'm Brian Lynn.
U.S. health officials are recommending that children wear masks this autumn when they return to school. Parents and policymakers, however, are debating whether face coverings should be required. The Delta variant of the coronavirus now threatens to affect normal behavior for the third school year. Some states have decided they will listen to the federal government's guidance and require masks. Others will leave the decision up to parents. The situation takes place at a time when many Americans want pandemic restrictions to end. Others fear their children will be put at risk by those who do not follow the restrictions. In a few states, lawmakers passed laws barring schools from requiring masks. In Connecticut, protests against mask requirements have happened outside Governor Ned Lamont's home in Hartford. Street signs call on him to unmask our kids. The governor has said that he is likely to follow the latest advice from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Last week, the CDC recommended indoor masks for all teachers, employees, students, and visitors at schools nationwide. It said people should wear masks whether or not they have been vaccinated. The agency said this was to stop the spread of the highly contagious Delta variant. The CDC has said even vaccinated people are getting infected. Alima Bryant is the mother of four children. She organizes parents in opposition to mask requirements in Branford, Connecticut. She said she believes scientists have overstated the dangers of COVID-19, especially for children. She said she will take her children out of school rather than force them to wear masks, which she believes are dangerous. I can imagine how often they're touching dirty things, then touching the mask, she said. Other parents, such as Ryan Zimmerman of Lenexa, Kansas, fear the refusal to wear a mask will just keep the pandemic around longer. In Johnson County, Kansas, five school districts recommend but do not require masks. A sixth school district has not yet decided. Zimmerman spoke at a recent meeting of county commissioners. He said that if masks are not required, 95% of kids won't be wearing them. He said requiring masks is not government control. It is about doing unto others as you want them to do unto you, he said. But another public meeting in Broward County, Florida, had to be stopped this week. More than 20 parents opposed to masks shouted at school officials and burned masks outside. Vivian Hugg is a Navy veteran. She said she was tired of the fear-mongering and giving up freedoms in the name of safety. There is also a campaign to get older children vaccinated. President Joe Biden has asked schools to open vaccine centers for children 12 years and older. Some states are also beginning to discuss whether to require school employees to be vaccinated or to regularly take tests for the coronavirus. To me, that seems very reasonable, said Dr. Joseph Cantor. He is the state health officer of the Louisiana Department of Health. You maintain some choice in there, and clearly most people are going to look at that and say it makes sense for them to get vaccinated, he said. I'm Susan Shand.
Think about American movies or books that you know. You have probably heard or read statements such as, "I guess so," "I don't think so," or "he said so." In today's everyday grammar, you will learn about the grammar behind such statements. We will explore shortened clauses. You will learn about the word "so," and how it commonly replaces one kind of clause in everyday speaking and writing. But first, let's begin by finding out what a clause is. Clauses are groups of words with a subject and a predicate, the part of the sentence that says something about the subject. When a clause is independent, it is a complete sentence. For example,
"I love grammar."
The subject is I, and the words "love grammar" make up the predicate. When a clause is dependent, it plays a part in a longer sentence. For example,
"I believe that learning grammar is important."
Here, the subject is I, and the predicate is "believe that learning grammar is important." Note that a dependent clause, "that learning grammar is important," appears in the predicate. There are different kinds of dependent clauses. The one we are interested in begins with the word "that," just like in the example you heard. You might be asking yourself how this discussion connects with the word "so." The answer is that English speakers often replace "that" clauses with the word "so," especially after certain verbs. The most common of these verbs include "guess," "think," and "hope." Consider this example. Imagine two people are trying to decide about something to watch.
"Have you seen this movie?"
"I don't think so."
In the example, the word "so" replaces a "that" clause. If the speaker did not use "so," the example would have sounded like this.
"Have you seen this movie?"
"I don't think that I have seen this movie."
English speakers often shorten noun clauses that would repeat what they have already said, or what another speaker has said. English speakers usually do not replace "that" clauses if the information is new. Let's think about another example.
"Did you remember to turn off the gas stove before we left the house?"
"I hope so."
Such an answer is not very convincing and should be a cause for concern. Please note that the example would have been longer if the word "so" were not used, As in?
Did you remember to turn off the gas stove before we left the house?
I hope that I remembered to turn off the gas stove before we left the house.
One reason English speakers replace that clauses with the word so is because of speed. It is much faster to not repeat information. Discussions that repeat so much information would become too long. The next time you are watching shows or reading books in English, pay careful attention to how speakers use the word so. Make note of which verbs they use, and be sure to look for other kinds of words they use to replace clauses. That might have to be a subject for another report. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. That Constitution, with other amendments added over the years, is still the law of the land. The delegates agreed to start the convention as soon as 7 states were represented. On May 25th, they finally began. They gathered in the same room where America's Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The first important decision was choosing a president for the convention. Several of the delegates urged the others to choose George Washington. Washington was the most famous man in America. He had led the forces that won the war for independence from Britain. The delegates agreed. Washington was their choice. George Washington officially opened the convention with a short speech. He thanked the delegates for naming him president of the convention. But, he said, the honor was too great. He asked the delegates to forgive him if he made mistakes. After all, he said, he had never been chairman of a meeting before. With those words, George Washington sat down. Here are 2 actors playing George Washington and James Madison. They discuss Washington's role in writing the Constitution.
As for that document, I merely stood back and let the learned gentlemen do their work. I believe I spoke only once in convention, and that to a minor point.
Well, I believe you do yourself an injustice, sir. As president of the convention, you led the way.
Washington did lead the way, but it was not a straight path. From the beginning, the delegates agreed that they had the right to change their decisions. This was the rule. The convention did not just discuss a proposal, vote on it, and move on to other issues. Any delegate could ask to again discuss any proposal or any decision.
and they often did. The same speeches that were made the first time were made again. So days, even weeks, passed between discussions of the same proposal. The delegates also agreed on a rule of secrecy. Guards were placed at the doors of the State House. Newspaper reporters were not allowed inside, and the delegates were not allowed to discuss convention business in public. The secrecy rule led people to think all kinds of things about the convention. This was true especially in Europe. There, most people believed the convention was discussing how America could be ruled by a king. Europeans said a republican government worked in a small country such as Switzerland, but it would not work, they said, in a land as large as America. At the time of the convention, Thomas Jefferson was serving as America's representative to France. When he learned of the secrecy rule, he was angry. He believed strongly in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. More than 40 years later, James Madison explained the decision behind the secrecy rule. Madison said that if the convention had been open to the public, no delegate would ever have changed his mind after speaking on an issue. To do so would mean he was wrong the first time he spoke, and no delegate would be willing to admit to the public that he had made a mistake. This was Madison's reasoning. If the meetings had been open, he said, the convention would have failed. Another rule helped the delegates speak freely. They used a method of debate known as the Committee of the Whole. It was useful then, and it is still used today in legislatures. Votes taken in the committee are not recorded as final votes. The Committee of the Whole provides a way for people to discuss ideas and vote, but also to change their minds. To have the Philadelphia Convention become a Committee of the Whole, the delegates needed to elect a chairman of the committee. They chose Nathaniel Gorham, a judge from Massachusetts. Each morning at 10 o'clock, the convention met and declared that it was sitting as a committee of the whole. George Washington then left the president's chair. Nathaniel Gorham took his place. Just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Committee of the Whole declared it was sitting again as a convention. Gorham would step down, Washington would take the chair, and declare that the convention would meet again the next morning. This process was repeated each day. Because of these rules, the story of the Philadelphia Convention would be difficult to understand if we told about events day by day. So we will put the calendar and the clock away and tell how each major issue was debated and settled. On May 29th, the delegates heard what was called the Virginia Plan. This was the plan of government prepared by James Madison and other delegates from Virginia. The Virginia Plan did more than suggest changes to the Articles of Confederation. It was, in fact, a plan for a completely new central government.
Immediately, the 33-year-old governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, proposed an amendment. The Virginia Plan, he noted, spoke of a federal union of states. But such a federation would not work, he said. Instead, Randolph suggested that the central government should be a national government. It should contain a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. For a few moments, there was complete silence. Many of the delegates seemed frozen in their chairs. Did they hear correctly? Most of them did not question the idea of a government with three separate branches. Several states already had such a system. But to create a central government that was national and supreme, what did these words mean exactly? What was the difference? The delegates debated the meaning of the words federal, national, and supreme for many days. Both James Madison and a Pennsylvania delegate, Governor Morris, tried to explain. Madison said a federal government acts on states. A national government acts directly on the people. Morris gave this explanation. A federal government is simply an agreement based on the good faith of those involved. A national government has a complete system of operation and its own powers. Governor Morris pointed out that one day the delegates meeting in Philadelphia would be dead. Their children and grandchildren, he said, would stop thinking of themselves as citizens of Pennsylvania or New York or North Carolina. Instead, they would think of themselves as citizens of the United States. Morris said the states had to take second place to a national government with supreme power. Other delegates presented their own plans for discussion. Alexander Hamilton of New York suggested giving the national government almost unlimited powers. Hamilton's ideas were not popular. After Hamilton's five-hour speech, one delegate said, "Hamilton is praised by everybody. He is supported by no one." New Jersey also offered a plan. An actor playing James Madison at a museum in Washington, D.C. says that plan was not popular either.
And William Paterson unveiled the New Jersey plan, calling for one house of equal representation. I knew that Delaware, Rhode Island, and the other small states would never go along with that.
Delegates voted to reject the New Jersey plan. They did not even vote on Hamilton's plan. From that time, all their discussions were about the plan presented by Virginia. For more than 3 months, delegates would debate each part, vote on it, then debate it again. The Virginia Plan formed the basis of discussion at the convention in Philadelphia. In the end, it formed the basis of the United States Constitution.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.